Hi, I'm Marisa McClellan, author of Food in Jars.
And I'm Joy Manning, editor of Edible Philly.
Welcome to Local Mouthful. We're here to talk about living the food life in Philadelphia and beyond. This week we're talking about stuff on toast, Pacific Northwest teriyaki, and the relationship between sleeping and eating. But first, let's compare notes on something we read this week.
Yes, it was the investigative report that set the food world, you know, on fire with suspicion.
Yeah.
And it was titled Farm to Fable. It was a multi-part investigative series from the Tampa Bay Times by their food critic, Laura Riley.
It is an impressive piece of reporting, first off. Like, it's a long, fascinating, deep dive into the food scene in Tampa and the ways in which restaurants are totally inventing their relationship to local food and how they source.
In a nutshell, what she did was she fact-checked the menus of farm-to-table restaurants. I'm sure this is a big thing in Philadelphia and obviously in Tampa and probably in most cities around the country. Restaurants really love to brag about the farmers that they support.
Their local sourcing.
She collected these menus and basically went to the farms or called the farms to just confirm that if they said that they were buying such and such a farm's tomatoes, that the farm was selling them tomatoes.
Yeah.
And they would find things like, we don't grow tomatoes, she found, or, you know, we did sell to them once, but not since then.
Yeah.
And the other thing that you and I were just talking about is the being in Florida, there's a lot of Gulf seafood advertised. And unlike produce, you can send seafood away to be DNA tested.
Yeah.
And she discovered that much of the seafood was not what it was advertised as at all.
Which is totally crazy. You're in Florida. I mean, granted, I know that some produce is hard to grow in Florida because there's a lot of pests. But even still, it's like it's warm pretty much all year round. You've got the Gulf.
Right.
Why is sourcing locally so hard? And why are they all lying about it so much? It's a little crazy.
I read some interviews with the writer, and she said she was a little surprised at the widespread national attention it got, but she did say that she thought it was reasonable to conclude that this type of, fraud is going on all over the country. And I don't know whether it's because I want to be in denial or I feel a certain dedication to our purveyors and restaurants here, but I have a hard time believing that it's as bad here.
Yeah, I would hope it's better here. I did see one of our local Fair Food folks tweet about this and really did say that that's why an organization like Fair Food in Philadelphia is so useful, because they're the ones building the relationships between the farmers and the restaurants. And so it becomes I don't know if it's just like clarity of sourcing or whatever, but it gave me the impression that hopefully when a restaurant in Philadelphia says that it's a locally sourced item, that that's actually true.
I was actually talking to a local farmer last week for a different reason about an Edible Philly story.
Uh-huh.
And I just brought this up and asked them about this. And they were saying that they do sometimes see their name on a menu where they have not recently sold to that restaurant, but they chalk it up to just being like laziness and not intentional deceit. I hope that's true.
I do too. I do know that, and I'm not going to name any names, but I had a friend who worked in local food in Philadelphia for a while. And he said that there were some farms that go to like farmers markets in the area who occasionally people reported that they would find like produce from like the big produce market in South Philly with their stickers, like squash where the stickers were still on it from just sort of like, mass commercial distribution. Which definitely gave me pause, but it doesn't feel like most people are behaving that way.
This is a huge piece of journalism. If you haven't seen it yet, we're definitely going to link to it in the show notes, and we would love to hear what you think about all of this and what is the level of confidence you have in your local farm to table restaurants. My confidence is maybe a little less than it once was, but I still feel like most of those places in Philly, or many of them, are really acting in good faith.
That is my hope, certainly. So from farm to fable to what's for dinner, and tonight what's up for dinner is stuff on toast. I, for one, I love stuff on toast. Any stripe of food on toast is good by me. It is definitely one of my fallback dinner, lunch, breakfast positions.
Yeah, I definitely like it, especially. Well, I do. I'm into stuff on toast 3 meals a day. I
mean, absolutely.
I wouldn't like to have all the meals in one day on toast, but I have on toast options for every any meal. Time of the day. Yeah. And I think one thing that makes it even more appealing to me now is I try to get to High Street to buy their amazing bread as much as possible.
Oh my God, their bread is so good.
And it really is like a great stage for any other ingredients. So what are some of the things you like to put on toast?
I sort of like a two-parter often. So like avocado and sauerkraut or mustard and cheese. Like I like a, you know, I need two ingredients on my toast. Or although an egg on toast, you need nothing else. It just, you know, a fried egg on toast is transportive.
I like scrambled eggs on toast, and I call it breakfast bruschetta. Sometimes I'll add some sauerkraut, actually.
I like that. I like that. I also am a big fan of peanut butter toast, and then I'll either layer some jam or some fruit on top. So when really good strawberries are in season, I'll just do peanut butter and then a layer of sliced strawberries, or if they're teeny tiny strawberries, and I'll just stud the whole thing with itty bitty strawberries.
I like peanut butter and slices of banana.
That is also delicious. Peanut butter, banana, and then a tiny drizzle of honey.
Huh.
That's like dessert to me, but that's a good one.
I haven't put honey on my peanut butter banana, but that sounds really good.
It's really good. I also, during the height of summer squash season, I always make this basically zucchini spread, zucchini butter.
I feel like I've had this.
Yes, I think I've given you somewhere. It's like zucchini that you cook down with olive oil and garlic and either rosemary and thyme and salt and pepper until it becomes almost this like sticky, spreadable paste. And it is so good on toast. What I like to do is, you know, like really good crusty sourdough, a thick layer of the zucchini butter, and then just a dusting of freshly grated Parmesan cheese.
That sounds great.
Is so good.
I'm a fan of almost any vegetable cooked until it's soft and mashed and put on toast, though. Cauliflower, I like.
That's a good one. Broccoli rabe, finely chopped, olive oil and garlic. Oh my God. Little ricotta.
You gotta have garlic situation.
Gotta have the garlic. But
that's
also
a really good one.
Really good olive oil. And then if you have like fresh ricotta from Claudio's, that is
the best.
I was in LA when for a few weeks ago, just like 3 weeks ago. And I went to Squirrel, which is this restaurant where they are one of these places that excels at toast. Mm-hmm. And so they serve like a very thick slice of multigrain bread with house-made ricotta and then their jam. And it's funny, I've been working on all these natural sweeteners for my new book, and I haven't eaten regular jam in so long now that the jam was like painfully sweet.
Huh.
But it was still so good. Just like the ricotta and the jam. That was delicious.
You know, our local stuff on toast specialist in Philly is right here near where you live, Vernick Food and Drink.
I am embarrassed to say I have not been there.
Oh, you have to go.
I know. I think I'm going to try to go for my birthday this year.
They have a whole section of on toast, and they put things on it like they're all pretty simple. One of my favorite is like peas and bacon.
Yum.
One has like – it's either some type of bacon or lardo layered over the top. I believe they have an avocado toast as well. It's just really good.
Yeah. I was just –
simple pleasures.
I was in Portland more recently, and I went to a place called Roman Candle. And they had – I shared two kinds of toasts with my friend Dina. And one was avocado, smoked salmon, and arugula, which was delicious. Mm. But the other one was butter and honey and bee pollen.
Yeah.
And that was really good,
too. I mean, this stuff on toast thing is definitely trendy, but I think people have been putting something tasty on top of bread for a long time.
It's just an easy meal formula, and you can, you know, dress it up, dress it down. It can be as basic or as sort of delicious and accessible as you need it to be.
And I feel like we'll probably keep doing it long into the future.
I hope so.
Long live stuff on toast.
I hope that bread never gets so villainized that we can't have things on toast.
Right. Well, now we're going to do something that comes up somewhat regularly on this show where you school me on something that I don't know about.
I don't think it happens that regularly.
Today's lesson is teriyaki.
Yes. So
can I just tell you what teriyaki means to me?
Yeah, please.
It's like the jar of sauce you buy at Trader Joe's. Like, that's kind of my whole understanding of it.
Well, I mean, the teriyaki sauce you buy at Trader Joe's is a fairly good representation of it. And I don't know necessarily that my understanding of teriyaki is the classic one, perhaps. But growing up in the Pacific Northwest, there were a lot of teriyaki places. And I hadn't really thought about it much until I spent a couple of weeks recently back again, I guess just a week, in the Pacific Northwest, so Portland and Seattle mostly. And I found myself seeking out the teriyaki places. And for me, the Pacific Northwest teriyaki, this also sort of crosses over with bento culture, but it's not bento boxes necessarily like you think of in a traditional Japanese term. But in my sort of high school years in Portland, there was this rise of the bento. And it was this plastic, black plastic box that they would pack with rice. You'd put a skewer of teriyaki chicken on top. You know, they'd pour warm teriyaki sauce on the rice, and then a strip, if you wanted it, of a sweet chili hot sauce. And that it's so it's totally meat and starch, but it is so good.
What is teriyaki chicken? Like, if you were going to make it.
So if I was going to make it, it would be a combination of soy sauce and perhaps a little garlic, some sugar, maybe some rice wine vinegar to kind of give it like that tanginess. Mm-hmm. Sometimes people add some toasted sesame oil. The sort of gold standard of teriyaki sauce that I grew up with was Mr. Yoshida's teriyaki sauce that you could buy at the grocery store. I've seen it at Costco here when I go to the New Jersey Costco. And what's funny is that Mr. Yoshida was actually a Portland guy who one of my parents' friends went to massage therapy school with. Mm-hmm. And he That's used funny. To bring his teriyaki sauce to the massage school. And people were like, this is so good, you should bottle it. And he did. But so
you take the sauce and you take your chicken.
You marinate.
Okay, what's the chicken?
It can be either like chicken breasts or boneless, skinless thighs. That's
Is typical. It always boneless?
It's not always, but that tends to be the format in which you get served most often.
And do you marinate it for a time?
You marinate it for a time, and then most of the time it's grilled. You know, so you get a little char. It's cooked all the way through. There's just a little bit of, you know, crunchy bits on the outside.
And you serve it with extra sauce.
You serve it with extra sauce and rice and then a vegetable if you're lucky. So I really started thinking about sort of this Pacific Northwest teriyaki culture because a couple weeks ago I did an event at the Beaverton Farmers Market. And on my
Where? What farmers market?
Beaverton. So it's a suburb of Portland. Okay. It's sort of a separate city. It's right next door to Portland, but it's often considered mostly like a suburb of Portland, Oregon. And on my way back, I was driving by the teriyaki place that my family used to go to when I was a kid. We moved to Southwest Portland in 1990, geez. And we started going to this place called Best Teriyaki on Canyon Road. And so I stopped there between events a few weekends ago and had what was essentially the exact same plate of food I ate from ages 11 to 15, until we moved out of that neighborhood. And it's boneless, skinless chicken thighs that have been marinated and grilled. They're a little bit fatty, but skinless. They have a lot of flavor. Then you get a big pile of white rice, and it's, you know, perfectly steamed, sort of sticky, starchy, but so good. And then a pile of sauteed cabbage with a few carrot shreds and a couple pieces of broccoli. And literally, it was just as I remembered it. It was the same food, and it only cost $2 more in 2016 than it did in 1990.
What does it cost now?
$7.95.
Oh my god!
Yeah, so the chicken can't be good quality, which is unfortunate. But for the food memory, I was willing to take that for the team. But so then, once I had that, I was like, oh my god, this is the teriyaki of my childhood. Let me see where else I can find this. So I went to another teriyaki place in Seattle when I was there called I Love Teriyaki, which was good, but they served it with an iceberg lettuce salad, which was not as satisfying to me.
Do you get that? I mean, is it like an orangey sauce like at other Japanese restaurants on salads?
No, they use a sweet cream dressing. And so it's very – what this is really is it's sort of like born out of the plate lunch tradition in Hawaii, where you get like rice and some meat or Spam and some sort of vegetable or little salad, or sometimes it's even like potato salad or macaroni salad, which I don't find as satisfying as like this pile of sauteed cabbage. But this was the food of my childhood in a lot of ways. You know, we would go to these teriyaki places, and all through high school there was a bento cart, but it's just funny, you don't see this food other places. The closest thing
I don't recall ever eating chicken teriyaki one time ever in my life.
Oh my God, I don't think a week went by in sort of my teenage years where I didn't have at least one serving of chicken teriyaki in some format or another.
Have you ever seen or been to a teriyaki joint in these parts?
No. There's nothing in the 14 years I've lived in Philadelphia, I've never found anything quite like it. The closest I can come to it in terms of like the ubiquity is like the old school Italian red sauce joints we have all over Philadelphia, where you can go in and get like a plate of spaghetti and meatballs for not too much money and get it relatively quickly.
Like culturally, it fills the same space.
Yeah.
It's the safe.
Mm-hmm.
The sure bet, the familiar food.
Yeah, that you know you're going to, you know basically what you're going to get. You know it's going to sort of meet a minimum requirement of flavor and satiation, and that you'll sort of be in and out relatively quickly.
Interesting.
Yeah, it's really funny to me.
There must be a million recipes for chicken teriyaki. I kind of want to try one, just so I know.
There is, and it's basically... Yeah, it's just marinate the meat for a little while. And honestly, I've used Trader Joe's. They have a version of the soy vey sauce that has sesame seeds in it. And that's pretty darn good stuff.
Do you make it at home?
Teriyaki sauce?
Teriyaki.
I will often. I mean, at home I'll often do like chicken legs and thighs. And I'll marinate them for a while and then just bake them like on a rack, on a cookie sheet, on a rimmed baking sheet. And that sort of mimics the experience. Most of the teriyaki I had as a child and teenager was like grilled either outdoors on a barbecue or on an internal, like a grill, not a flat top, but a grill.
It's interesting.
But it's weird. It's one of those things I never really thought about until I got here and I had it there, and then I came back and was like, huh, you don't see this in Philadelphia.
Oh, I'm so glad you got to flash back to your youth.
It was really nice, actually. So I managed to have chicken teriyaki 3 times in a week. And it was satisfying every time.
That's great. You made me really want to try to at least cook it if I can't go out and eat it.
But the sort of sticky white rice is definitely part of the experience.
Huh. Oh, you know how I feel about white rice.
You love it.
I love it.
Yeah. And then a pile of sort of peppery cabbage with some broccoli. It's just so good.
Sounds good to me. Maybe I'll get to the Pacific Northwest at some point and try it myself.
So let's talk a little bit about the relationship between sleeping and eating. So have you ever noticed that when you're really sleep deprived, you're hungrier? You feel like you need more food?
Yeah. Well, there's a lot of studies that show that when we don't sleep enough, we eat more calories and that we also reach for different types of calories than we would if we were well rested.
It is so true. I find that when I haven't gotten enough sleep, I feel like I try to use food as a replacement for that sleep. Like if I eat more protein or carbs, it'll somehow give me that extra energy I missed by not getting enough sleep
I don't actually think it's psychological. I think it's biological.
Oh, I think it is. But I also sometimes I think about it. I'm like, oh, well, I'm really tired. I should eat more.
Yeah. I eat just the worst stuff when I don't sleep enough. And, you know, we talk a lot about what makes for your good food life and what we think is eating for wellness. And sometimes I think that we don't, not just you and I, but the whole conversation around food. And we don't talk about the other things that contribute.
Yeah.
What makes it possible. And I think a good night's sleep is one of those things that makes it possible, you know, not just because biologically you'll be set up to eat fewer calories and make better choices. You'll just have more energy and maybe feel like cooking. I have been known to call sleep vitamin Z because I think really important. It's part of a good nutrition program.
Well, the other problem with when you haven't gotten enough sleep is that you do make poor food choices because you're tired. So it's sort of like, who wants to make a big salad or make a really great stir fry or something when you are limited on energy?
Right.
So those are the moments when you, more often than not, at least I, will succumb to takeout. And luckily in my neighborhood, some of the takeout options are getting a little bit better. Mm-hmm. But for the most part, when we order takeout, it's pizza or Chinese food.
It's like a cycle that starts first thing in the morning. You don't get enough sleep. You don't want to get out of bed. Yeah. Maybe then you don't leave time for breakfast. So if you skip breakfast, then at 10 a.m. or whatever, now you're really hungry. And maybe you're going to eat a muffin or something that's not going to make you feel good.
And it just makes you tired because it's sugar and carbs.
Your blood sugar goes up. Your blood sugar comes down. Now you need an afternoon snack, or maybe you reach for a can of soda or whatever. And the next thing you know, you're ordering a pizza or whatever, you know, and it's not.
And then you eat too much pizza and it makes you feel bad. And mm-hmm. then you don't get a good night's sleep because your stomach's a little bit upset.
True.
And then you start the cycle all over again.
And I think people can sometimes blame themselves for this, like they're weak-willed or whatever. But I don't think it's a matter of being weak-willed. I think it's a matter of, you know, we're human, we're animals, like, yeah. basically. And we need certain things in order to be functioning at our best. And sleep is so overlooked. Like, we live in this crazy culture where not sleeping is a badge of honor.
I find that so insane. I saw an interview recently with Arianna Huffington, and she's become a really big proponent of sleep because a few years back, she passed out and she thought something was really wrong with her. And it turned out she was just chronically sleep deprived. Mm-hmm. And so she went from someone who really prided herself on not getting a lot of sleep to someone who is really a big believer in sleep and sort of, advocates it for her employees. I think they have nap rooms at the Huffington Post, and just made me realize how much our culture sort of celebrates people who don't sleep.
Right.
Which is insane.
I really make it a priority. I try to be in bed at 11.
Yeah.
And, you know, I try to sleep until 7. And to me, it is as big a priority as work, you know, and also having a good meal plan and a good nutrition plan. What time do you have a bedtime?
I really try to be getting ready for bed by like 11:30 and in bed with the lights out by midnight, because most days I don't get up till 8. Mm-hmm. Although that schedule used to work better for Scott and me when he went to work at 9. He changed his work schedule a while back, mm-hmm. and so now he gets up at 7, mm-hmm. And hasn't made the sleep bedtime shift. Mm. And so I feel like he just gets more and more tired throughout the week, and then over the weekend sort of stocks up on sleep, which
you can't actually
do. So I think that we need to start shifting our bedtime. Not that we have to go to bed together, but you know, we're the only two people in this apartment. It sometimes just makes more sense to go to bed at the same time. So I think we need to advocate for earlier bedtimes.
I try to make Dan go to bed at the same time as me. It doesn't always work.
Yeah.
You know, I'm a freelancer. I could get up whenever I want, but I get up when he gets up.
Yeah.
So we can have breakfast together. And it's all part of the same, like, I'm a big fan of Gretchen Rubin. And I think she calls these, like, the foundation habits: sleeping, food and drink, and exercise. And it's true. If you try to strengthen that foundation, like, most things in your life will work better. And I do think that a big reason people don't want to cook is they just don't have the energy. And a big reason they don't have the energy is because they're just not sleeping enough.
True enough.
So I think we should all make a priority of going to bed. Another thing Gretchen Rubin suggests is setting the bedtime alarm.
Uh-huh. Oh, that's
like, you
smart.
Know how most people set an alarm to get up in the morning? She mm-hmm. says set an alarm for the time that you want to go to bed at night.
Yeah.
And can I actually share another tip of hers that is helping me?
I love the idea of a bedtime alarm, so lay it on me.
Okay. So she says, obviously, you have to brush and floss your teeth before you go to bed.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of people do that last thing.
Yeah.
I was one of those people. But instead, she says, I like to wind down by reading.
Mm-hmm.
And she's like, when you start to wind down for the night, you know, put on your pajamas and brush and floss before you're too tired to brush and floss. Because I used to get into a thing where I would be reading, I'd be tired, but I'd be too tired to brush and floss, but so I couldn't go to sleep until I did it.
Yeah.
So I like became a procrastination cycle where like I didn't. So now like it is not unusual for me to brush and floss at like 9:30.
I've done that where, you know, I just kind of, I start putting things away and I'm like, oh, I'll do this now. But maybe I'll try to make more of a habit of it. Because that does happen to me where I'm on the couch and I'm so tired. And the idea of getting up and getting ready for bed just seems exhausting.
So get ready before you hit that exhaustion wall. Do whatever you're – do you have a wind down thing that you do at night?
I sometimes read,
I sort of have this picture that you're like plugging away on your laptop until you're like pass right
well,
out.
Well, I tried to make a rule a while ago that I wouldn't have my laptop open past 10 p.m. So
I have definitely gotten emails from you at like 12:30 a.m.
That is true. But I try not to do that too much.
I almost never do that.
If I find that groove, but then it wakes me up and then it screws up my sleep or I start worrying about things.
Yeah, I'm a big proponent of the screens off.
Yeah.
Okay. Well we want you guys to sleep more, eat better. Tell us what you think. Do you have experiences where sleeping better has helped you eat better or sleeping worse has made you eat worse? come to our blog and share your experiences.
Chime in.
And if you have tips for getting better and enough sleep, definitely share them. We all need them.
Absolutely.
So let's talk about our favorite local spring vegetable.
Okay.
Asparagus.
I love it.
Who doesn't?
There are a few people, but I think they're crazy.
I think it is so good. It's one of the happiest vegetables because it really means the growing season is here. Yeah. And it's got such a distinctive, wonderful flavor. It's so versatile. What are some of your favorite ways to use it?
Well, most of the time when I'm working with asparagus, I'm just going to roast it. I'm going to cut off the ends, wash it real well, because I love local asparagus, but it can be a little grittier mm-hmm. than grocery store stuff. So soak it to make sure I've gotten all the grit out of the tips, and then just dry them, olive oil, salt, pepper, hot oven, till sort of the tips are crispy and the stalks are tender.
I certainly make it that way. That's a delicious way to enjoy asparagus. And one of those ways that I think you can pass off to vegetable haters or people that are just not into eating their vegetables. I also find myself pairing asparagus with eggs all the time.
Yes. Yes.
I like asparagus like cut on a steep bias and then sautéed in butter with scrambled eggs. I don't know why. That's like one of the most delicious ways to eat it. It
is totally delicious.
Or in a frittata if you want to get more organized. Mm-hmm. I also love to put it on like some puff pastry and then have like an asparagus tart.
Yes, 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 yes.
That's a really special way.
I have done that many times. And I used to – and I what I like to do is chop shallots up real small mm-hmm. and put them on the bed of the puff pastry and then lay the asparagus over
That's
it.
That's a great idea.
So you get that little bit of like roasted shallot zing mm-hmm. That comes through. So when you do that, do you keep the stalks whole or do you chop them up and sort of scatter them?
What I actually do is I like slice them in half and then I put them cut side down on the pastry. Smart. And sometimes if I'm feeling really fancy, I spread a thin layer of sour cream or creme fraiche under the asparagus.
Ooh.
It's really good.
The only thing that I used to do them in stalks and just leave them whole. Mm-hmm. And then I discovered it was easier to eat.
Definitely.
If you chop them up and so have like this.
What about your Instagram, though?
I know. But it still looks good. It's just not as perfect and pristine.
I think that the whole stalk is such a splashy.
It does.
But you're right. It is easier to eat.
Yeah. I also love to pickle asparagus.
Of course you do.
As this should come as no surprise to you. Pickled asparagus to me is the first local preserve I get to make each year. And it makes me so happy.
Do you do like a hot... Do you do like a vinegar pickle with it?
I do. I haven't fermented it.
I wonder if you even can.
I don't know. It might get too funky.
Yeah.
I'm sure Amanda Pfeiffer would be able to tell us though. But I love to do a vinegar pickle with garlic and some red chili flakes and black peppercorn and maybe some mustard seed.
Do you peel the bottom?
No. Do you peel the bottom?
Frequently. And I haven't made pickles, but I feel like if I were going, I'm assuming they're not cooked much, right? Or they just have the hot.
I tend to blanch them quickly, mm-hmm. so maybe 30 seconds of blanching, and then pack them into jars.
You might, I don't know if you're doing like a zillion tons of asparagus at once, but you might try peeling them a little bit. It just makes for like that, you know, that exterior, it's a little fibrous.
No, that's a good idea. My grandma Bunny used to peel asparagus. You know me, anytime I don't have to peel something, like celery, I don't do it.
But I was making some asparagus the other day. I peeled like 5 stalks and I was like, forget it.
But no, I think for pickles, you're right. That could also help you skip the blanching step, which is kind of a pain, mm-hmm. and just go straight to the pickling.
Probably.
But, oh God, it's so good.
Pickled. Another thing I like to do with asparagus is, even though soup is sort of like the last things on our minds this time of year, I love asparagus soup. So sometimes I'll make it and save it.
Well, and it's such a good way to use up the woodier ends,
true.
Too.
You know, because it's a very flavorful stock. Yeah.
I will certainly sometimes puree it and then use the ends with like onions and lots of aromatic, delicious stuff, and then puree the soup and then push it through a sieve so that I remove all those woody bits, but I still get all the flavor.
Yeah. Asparagus. I will just keep eating it until it's gone.
Yeah. I got some in Portland and it was so good.
The best. It is my favorite seasonal local vegetable, maybe tied with tomatoes.
Yeah.
Well, that's about it for this week's installment of Local Mouthful. Many thanks to Dan Call for editing the show and to Saul Rosenbaum for designing our cute logo. Thanks to Raina Rose for providing the music, and thank you for listening. If you like what you hear, please subscribe via iTunes or your favorite podcasting app and follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at Local Mouthful. Sign up for our newsletter, catch up on our old episodes, and check out our show notes at localmouthful.com. Until next time, Happy eating.